Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this evening is the observance night, last observance day for me to be here before I take off on sabbatical. 30 more shaving days before I come back. And certainly my intention, aspiration while I'm away is to spend a good chunk of time in retreat and focusing attention on meditation, on study, on review of the teachings. I think that's, I should be able to do that, of putting myself in the situation where it should be amenable to that intention. And I think just reflecting or considering my own situation of having been in a leadership position, responsibility, and then to step back from that for a while and to just spend time practicing without anything else kind of intruding, that's a great opportunity for me personally. But it's also a kind of an indication of the kind of depth of profundity that the teachings of the Buddha signify. It's not something that one just sort of reads one day and then decides to penetrate it. It's certainly what I thought it was when I first started. I remember starting after doing my first meditation retreat and then being in a monastery in Bangkok and contemplating ordination for 3 or 4 months at the maximum, thinking, yeah, this shouldn't be very difficult. Just ordain for a little bit, and at least sort of should be Sotapanna or Sakadagami. Then I can continue traveling. But, seemed pretty easy. But, if you continue to practice, I just see the depth and the nuances, the subtleties of the teaching will start to really become apparent. And the degree to which one needs to be patient, persistent, diligent, discerning, in order to really understand it, to really penetrate it, and to really reap the benefit from the practice. It starts to become more and more apparent, and as one does, then he does that, then the or in my mind anyway, my heart, the tremendous appreciation and awe at the insight of the Buddhas and his ability to teach and transmit. So to take time and really just have that opportunity to be with the practice, be with the teachings, to I'm really looking forward to it, and it's a wonderful thing. I remember one time, it was when I was the abbot of Wat Nanachat, early days, and I got to know the Supreme Patriarch of in Thailand, and the former Supreme Patriarch. I can't remember the name of the monastery that he was at. Present one is in Wat Bawan. And used to go. He was quite old at that time, it started by going and taking some tapes of Ajahn Chah to him. Having a collection of tapes, and been sort of squirreling them away for quite some time, and then copying them. So I took them to offer. And then taking the Ajahn Chah's books. And he was so grateful. And used to go down and just pay respects and chat and talk, and he really enjoyed talking Dhamma, and he really had this tremendous appreciation and gratitude for Ajahn Chah's teachings and for his and then he'd, because he had the time, and he was making the time, even because being Supreme Patriarch, you can fill your time with all sorts of things people are wanting you to. But it's mostly ceremonial and ritual. You want him to bless this and bless that, and he was getting older, and he was really just not buying into that, and was spending his time meditating and listening to Dhamma teachings and reviewing and recollecting the study that he'd done when he was a young monk, suttas, and reviewing his life, and a life very well lived. And it was quite lovely to just sit and talk with him and chat. And, sometimes it'd be about pretty mundane things. A lot of the times it would be about meditation, about suttas, about reflections on Dhamma. And it was kind of obvious as well that he really... It was rare that he had the opportunity to talk about Dhamma. Being in an administrative position, that the Supreme Patriarch, and he really cherished that. It was also quite funny. One time I brought out the whole community down one time. I can't remember why we were in Bangkok. I took the majority of the community from Wat Nanachat took them over, paid respects, and asked for teachings, and he gave us a whole talk on saying, "I know you're forest monks and you eat one meal a day, and my advice to you is to really chew your food well." It was very sweet. That opportunity to reflect on the teachings, and I think also to just returning, and this is something that we need to do in our spiritual practice, our Dhamma practice, is the, how do we keep renewing our practice? How do we keep the practice fresh? Because it's easy to just get used to it, or get bored by it, or get frustrated because we don't think we're getting what we should, or develop perceptions of who we are and what we are as practitioners, and to return to that kind of, to be able to keep that freshness of, you know, kind of confidence and enthusiasm that was what propelled us on our search, on our aspiration to really commit ourselves to practice and training. And one of the this afternoon, when I was sitting in the Patimokkha, one of the thoughts that came up in my mind was the recollecting the Ratapala Sutta, and that the Ratapala, being a very wealthy son, only son, of the kind of most influential family, Brahmin family, in this particular town, city, and there's a whole story of him seeking, trying to get, listening to the Buddhist teachings, getting faith, gaining faith, asking permission from his parents to ordain, his parents not wanting to grant permission, and he basically, sort of, after some to-ing and fro-ing and trying to convince each other of the rightness of their perceptions, and he just sort of laid down on the floor in the house and said, "Well, either I'm going to die right here, or I'm going to ordain." And so after some time, they relented when it looked like he was obvious and he was actually going to follow through on that. So he ordained, went off, attained arahantship after some time. In no long time, dwelling ardent, aloof. And then he went back to his hometown, and his parents and family tried to entice him back into the world, and he didn't, wasn't interested. And after a frustrating time with his family, went to the park, and the king heard that he was there. So the king went to visit him. And the king had, by the sutta, it's obvious that that Ratapala had, from the time that he left home to the time he returned, it was quite some time. The commentaries say 12 or 15 years. But it's definitely some period of time, because the father didn't recognize him. So when he heard Ratapala was in the park, staying there, then he went and visited him. And he asked him, what was it that made you ordain, or gave you the willingness to ordain, or the intention to ordain, and because he felt it was rather strange. You see, he sort of said, "Yeah, normally when people would ordain, it would be because there was some loss, loss of wealth, loss of health, loss of relatives." And it was obvious that wasn't the case. He was wealthy. He was young when he ordained. Had lots of friends and relatives, big circle of friends and relatives. So that he, then Ratapala said, "Well, it's these, because of these ways of particular ways of viewing the world that, provided him with the confidence or the aspiration to leave the world." And saying that there's four of them. Said like four measures of the world, how one measures or views the world. The life in any world. Is swept away. It doesn't endure. Life in any world is without protector, without security, or without that sense of having something that is making it secure. There isn't any protection. Life in any world is without ownership. Everything it has to be taken away from us. And life in any world is incomplete, is insatiable. And those if one reflects on the sort of the teachings, it's interesting actually in that sutta that that's actually the only place in the suttas that comes up. So whether it's something that Ratnapala thought up himself sort of peculiar to him, or it's a kind of a particular structure of teaching that was used at the time of the Buddha but hasn't been passed on in any other suttas and discourses. I'm not sure, but it's interesting. But it corresponds to, you know, to different aspects of Dhamma, and say anicca, dukkha, anatta, and craving. So that tanha. The life in any world is swept away. It doesn't endure. It's the impermanence. And the that sense of and it's interesting that the way the idiom is, or how it's spoken, that life in any world, it's not just, you think, well, if I get a, you know, maybe if I die, or I'll go to some other world where it'll be better than this one. Well, no, it doesn't matter which world you go to. The same of, like, well, if it doesn't work out here in California, I'll go to Canada. Well, it's the same thing. Don't like it here in America, go to Asia, and it'll be different. Well, it won't be. It's life in any world or any place, it's swept away. It's unenduring. It's impermanent. It's changing. The images that the Ratnapala gives examples or images for the king to make it tangible, and then he just points to the reality of the king was quite old at that point, and saying, you know, when you were young, you know, what was it like for you? Were you strong, healthy? Were you a good swordsman, a good archer? And nobody could match me. And you know, and what's it like now for you? So, oh wow, I'm pretty old and decrepit, and sometimes I want to step here, and I've misstep. Faculties just aren't like they were. So it's just swept away. It's unenduring, even when one is. Yes, strong and healthy. You know, it's just this impermanence, this change. And, you know, I think when we're younger, we might think that things aren't going to change. But you know, it's just as time goes on, you just see, it's just everything is being swept away, it's changing, it's being undermined in its solidity. The hope of some sort of stability is impossible. To really be reflecting on impermanence. And you think back on, you know, what Ajahn Chah, that was the point that he kept hammering away at, pounding away at, teaching over and over and over in so many different ways. Impermanence, uncertainty, change. It's all going to change. It's all uncertain. This is unsure. Whether it's the material realm, or whether it's the mental realm, whether it's in the world or in the realm of the spiritual, uncertainty and change are endemic. That's the way it is. So that to really take that on brings us back to the Dhamma, because that's, if we're seeking refuge and seeking real security, then we need to find it in the Dhamma. And it's not just a teaching or memorizing a discourse, but it's in motivation to really penetrate, to see clearly, to be able to let go. When all is swept away, then the only thing left to do is to really let go. That life in any world is without protector. It's without the say security is not quite right, but it's first with the that sense of dukkha is impinging all the time. Dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and that is a constant presence. That what we experience is going to be there's this sense of unsatisfactoriness. The complication of existence and life in any world is like that. There's nothing can protect us from death. Nothing can protect us from pain. Nothing can protect us from. It's like the image that that Ratapala gives. Is asking the king if he has any chronic ailment. And the king sort of says, yeah, I've got this chronic wind ailment, and sometimes I'm in a lot of pain. And the Ratapala then sort of says, yeah, well, and then can you, when you're suffering from that pain and that discomfort, you've got all the your courtiers and family around you, can you ask them to share it with you? Can just to alleviate your pain and discomfort? And of course, no, I have to experience that by myself. I can't, nobody can share that. Nobody can take that away. And that is so that without that, there isn't some sort of protector who can take away the pain of and discomfort of life in any world. This is what it's like. We have to experience it ourselves, and we can't even pay anybody or ask anybody to share it or take it away. So that this is the nature of any world. And there is this endemic, and that's what is in the classic formulation of what is dukkha. It's birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are dukkha. Separation from the liked is dukkha. Association with the disliked is dukkha. Not getting what we want is dukkha. In short, the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. So the pervasiveness of that quality of dukkha is, and it's in any world. And so that recollecting that, reminding oneself of that, so that we see it clearly, because it's easy to try to focus on some, you know, try to forget that by focusing on some something pleasant, and sensual gratification, something pleasant, exciting, but you know that doesn't last, or you know some ideal, whether it's you know philosophical or religious. Or some hope for the future of somehow, somewhere in the future, one's not going to experience suffering. So we keep running away from it. And so to be able to really look at that and say, this is the Anga is like, this is the way to measure the world. This is the way to perceive the world. Life in any world is without protector. Being able to take on that reality. And the third one, life in any world is without ownership. I was pointing to the quality of anatta, that non-self aspect, without ownership, without whatever we have, we end up having to be separated from it. And whatever wealth, possessions, fame, good fortune, name, whatever. In the end, death comes, and we can't sort of. It's impossible to cut a deal somehow so that we're. We can take it into the next life. It's just not possible. We die and we leave everything behind. What's left is our karma, and that's what we carry with us. And so that karma of if we're accumulated the karma of attachment, clinging, getting caught and swept up in our moods and our conflicts, confusions. That's what we take with us. And we've been doing that for long enough. We've been doing that way too long. It's like the other day in the reading, one of the readings was on the nature of samsara, that the beginningless nature, this endless nature of being without beginning, without end, nature of samsara, that even if one looked at tried to sort of calculate it, it's completely impossible to try to calculate how how long samsara is. And one of the images that the Buddha uses is that, you know, the tears that we've shed out of grief for the sort of disappointments we've felt, the loss of through death of our mothers, our fathers, all of the tears that we shed out of that, we could over this endless round of rebirth could fill the four great oceans, and that it still wouldn't approximate the number of times that we've been reborn. It's a long, long time. I mean, even if you lead a really miserable life, you probably couldn't get more than a bucket or two of tears in one lifetime. assuming that it's that you keep going up and down, and you know some are, say, less miserable than others. still, you know, trying to count out all those buckets of tears. That's a lot of lives. I think that's that. It's time to cut the cord of clinging, the cord of attachment that goes out to that sense of self, sense of me. Me and my problems, me and my preferences, me and my views and opinions. And really seeing this, you know, life in any world is without ownership. It's really seeing that non-self quality. And the last standard or measure of the world is that the life in any world is incomplete. It's insatiable. You know, we'd never have enough. And of course, Ratapala uses an image that is quite appropriate for a king. Asking him if you hear about a kingdom that's nearby, or some messenger comes and says that there's a kingdom over there and it's got lots of wealth and lots of resources, and it's sort of there for the taking. All you need to do is march your army in and you can get it. You know, what would you do? I say, well, I'd march my army in and take it. And of course, you know, so it's in this direction and that direction all around. Of course, there's no end to that. And and it's never as one appears, because desire always sets up a perception that doesn't accord with reality whatsoever. And nothing much changes. I mean, this is given to a king in the over 2,500 years ago. And we'll go over there and they'll welcome us with flowers and good thing. Take democracy to them. Get a bit of oil. it'll all work out. Well, maybe it won't. That desire, and when it's driven by desire, there's no end to craving. You know, and whether it's on a global level, in terms of kingdoms and empires, or it's just on this ordinary moment-to-moment outflow toward just accumulating of pleasurable sensation, pleasurable sight, sound, smells, taste, pleasurable feelings through the mind. It's still, as long as it's driven by craving, then you're always going to feel the incomplete. There's never a sense of completion. There's always going to feel incomplete. And this unsatiated. And that's why the Buddha is the importance of reflecting on the nature of the world, so that we can turn to that which is going to make us complete. And it isn't through getting anything, gaining anything, achieving, accomplishing anything in the world, but through relinquishment, through seeing clearly, through insight, through penetration, and through contentment. And to actually be content, you know, whether we experience something that's pleasant or unpleasant, you know, can we be content? Whether we succeed at something, we're successful, we succeed in our meditation, we succeed in our some material task that we set for ourselves, or we fail, and can we be content knowing that, okay, well, I tried, I had a good intention, I put forth effort as best I could, and yeah, that's what happened. That's what it was like. Okay. So can we be content with that? Because that's where we cut off the craving. Whether we're praised or we're criticized, can we be content? So that quality of contentment coming from Dhamma, you know, contentment isn't a blind putting up with stuff or blindly trying to shut down any kind of interest in things around one. Can we be content? We're not a slave to craving. That desire, craving, attachment, clinging. Because if there's just that quality of contentment, it just undercuts and nullifies craving. If we're able to allow the heart to really settle in contentment, you know, and in order to be content, one has to be extraordinarily clear. And that the peacefulness of the heart, you know, when the heart is really full. It doesn't need to seek any other experience. I mean, that's why we practice meditation. That's why we cultivate mindfulness. Because there's so much distraction going on in the mind, and we get drawn out, and it just keeps repeating the cycles of craving. You know, and whether the craving is for that which is pleasant, or whether we just want to annihilate and shut off, it's still craving. Then to be able to turn our attention. Again, this is why we practice Dhamma. Yes, and that's our. On some level, that's what motivated us to practice in the first time, in the first place, that this recognition or this intuition that this really is the nature of the world. It's impermanent, it's unsatisfactory, it's non-self, and this craving and desire is what is binding us to this round of suffering, and that's, we want out. And you know, that wanting out can't be sort of sought through just annihilating the world, because that's another creating a world of aversion. Just being able to see really clearly our life in any world is like this, and we can just let it be like that. But to step back and dwell in a place of clarity, place of non-clinging, and non-movement. When I say non-movement, I mean it's not like we're not doing anything or engaged in anything. It's like Ajahn Chah was somebody who, you know, had this tremendous sense of non-movement, stillness. He wasn't shaken by anything. He wasn't trying to be anybody. Tremendous energy, tremendous presence. And that's what, because he was really with Dhamma. And so that's the opportunity that we have. To keep returning to that. That's what, say, what Ajahn Chah calls, that's our real home. Our real home isn't sort of the world of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self, craving. Our real home is an abiding place of Dhamma, and this is what the Buddha points to, gives us the opportunity to realize, to penetrate, to ascertain, so that you know, I think again the sense of recollecting how profound the Buddha's teachings are, it's a big motivation to really practice, and to renew practice, to renew, to rejuvenate, to refresh. So we need to be doing that all the time. And for myself, that's certainly something that I'm looking forward to, delighting in. It's just that opportunity to refresh, rejuvenate. And you know, over these years that I've been ordained and have been practicing, taken retreats, done retreats, shorter or longer periods of retreat, and there's almost always a sense of being refreshed and rejuvenated in some other recognition of the beauty of the Buddha's teachings, and some refreshed and rejuvenated in recognizing again some sort of very subtle or sometimes not so subtle even, something you've been missing, and being able to incorporate that and allow it to strengthen the practice and allow myself to sort of more deeply enter into that well of the Buddha's teachings. It's sort of like a Sagajan Cha, one of the images that he uses for when we gain insight. I said it's like a well that, like a good well, is always being rejuvenated. And said, especially in Mendocino, that is a real, it's a very apt image, because so many of the wells around here go dry in the summertime. But to have a well that is produces water all the time, this is always a source of refreshment and sustenance. Mm-hmm. So that for our practice to keep returning to this well of the Dhamma that can nourish us, and that's a wonderful opportunity. So that for myself, that's what I'm going to be doing, and that's what sustains me. So that during this time away, I hope that all of you turn attention to how to sustain and rejuvenate and refresh yourselves as well with the Dhamma. So I'll offer that for reflection.
Annamayam dhammakatha sadhukaram